For the next couple of weeks, we're going to do something a little bit different, and we're going to start a new series called Elephant in the Church. I'm assuming I'm supposed to hit this one, right? There we go. Elephants in the Church, and if you know the kind of the little saying, and that is, you know, the elephant in the room, and it's like something that everybody knows about, but nobody's talking. Maybe it's a family issue that everybody knows there's an issue in the family, but nobody says anything. And sometimes church can kind of get like that, where there's elephants, there's very relevant, very current event things going on, and it's just kind of like that. It never happened, you know? It's just kind of disappearing. So this we were talking about last week when we were talking about prayer, and Mickey and I were sharing our prayer journeys and where we are, and I really concluded kind of pushing us in the direction of Nehemiah. And Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king. He was not a preacher running around. He was just the average working guy. He had a great position. The downside to his job is if anything was poisoned, he died first. Okay, so there's an upswing in the fact that you're with the king. Downside is you could die at any moment because someone may want to try to poison the king. But this is who Nehemiah was, and when he heard that the walls were down and the people were not doing well, he immediately went to God, and his heart cried out. And so we're kind of going along with that thought process to say, okay, what's kind of some of the elephants in the church? And in so doing, what's kind of breaking, you know, the heart of God? What's on his mind? And I think in this season, even though a lot of times it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we're going to talk about this, but we are. We're going to talk about politics this morning, probably not in the way that you envision. So what I would say to you is this, everyone that just as soon as I heard the word politics, put their guard up, put it back down, okay? Everybody went, you know. We're not going to probably go the direction that you think that we're going to go. I don't endorse candidates. I don't do anything like that. I'm not going to steer people. Number two with that, that's just my conviction. Number two is it's also illegal for a 501c3 to do so. I don't know if you've caught the news lately, but there's some pastors that are really trying to push it to see if the IRS will go after them, and I'm like, what's the point in this? Because usually what happens is, as much as we want to say that politics can bring about unity, what do we really know at our core of our being? Politics usually does what? It divides, you know? And boy, if there's not a clear division in our nation's history, it's now. I mean, it's about as clear as can be. I mean, there isn't much room in between. And so I wanted us to talk about it this morning, using that as the backdrop of what Nehemiah went through, okay? It was a very politically charged arena. He was asking the king of the conquered land, okay? He's asking that king to say, please help me go back and rebuild that place that your forefathers destroyed. And on top of that, I need you to pay for it. Now, that's what he asked for. You're talking about politically charged. That's pretty bold. As a matter of fact, it's probably pretty foolish when you really think about it. Because he could have said, I tell you what, Nehemiah, you're sure going back, but you're going back in pieces. That's how you're going back. Because you don't ever bring up those things. But see, Nehemiah was such a faithful servant and such a good person around the king that the king knew there's something about this guy that's a little bit different. And so that king said, sure, put his seal of approval on the things, not only gave him what he asked for, gave him even more things. And this is what God did in a very politically charged arena. And then Nehemiah walked into a very politically charged arena because guess what? There were people there that when they saw they were going to rebuild the walls, here's what they knew. It wasn't that they were against the walls being rebuilt. It was the fact that they knew they would lose their power. Incredibly charged arena within the political realm of his day, and that's what he walked into. So we're going to talk a little bit about that this morning. If you have your Bibles, the ones there in front of you, it's Judges chapter 17. It's on page 227 is where we're going to start. Page 227. And this story, as we progress through it, you may kind of go, I'm not quite sure what all of this is about. And so we're going to kind of go back through a little bit verse by verse to kind of explain what was kind of going on at the time. Judges chapter 17, page 227. There was a man named Micah who lived in the hill country of Ephraim. One day he said to his mother,
His mother, sure. His mother, I heard you place a curse on the person who stole 1,100 pieces of silver from you. Well, I have the money. I was the one who took it. The Lord bless you for admitting it, his mother replied. He returned the money to her, and she said, I now dedicate these silver coins to the Lord. In honor of my son, I will have an image carved and an idol cast. So when he returned the money to his mother, she took 200 silver coins and gave them to a silversmith, who made them into an image and an idol. And these were placed in Micah's house. Micah set up a shrine for the idol, and he made a sacred ephod. Now let me just kind of pause there, because anytime you see a word you don't know, you probably stop right there and you don't hear the rest of the story. So let me just stop at that one. That was the special garment that the priests and the Levites would wear. Okay, so this is what he's now made, all right, this special garment. And some household idols. Then he installed one of his sons as his personal priest. In those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. One day, a young Levite who had been living in Bethlehem in Judah arrived in that area. He had left Bethlehem in search of another place to live, and as he traveled, he came to the hill country of Ephraim. He happened to stop at Micah's house as he was traveling through. Where are you from? Micah asked him. He replied, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am looking for a place to live. Stay here with me, Micah said, and you can be a father and priest to me. I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, plus a change of clothes and your food. Levite agreed to this, and the young man became like one of Micah's sons. So Micah installed the Levite as his personal priest, and he lived in Micah's house. I know the Lord will bless me now, Micah said, because I have a Levite serving as my priest. Now, let me tell you what's kind of going on here. If you read sometime maybe this week or in the next couple weeks, a couple of the chapters around this one, you'll notice that all of a sudden this story just appears out of nowhere. We don't have any backdrop or background information about Micah and his mother. All of a sudden, there's just this story. And there's really not a follow-up story with this one. So it's just kind of all of a sudden talking about some things, and here's this story. And let me tell you what's going on here. God is showing us a case study of the average person that was living at that time. So for those of you in the psychology field or behavioral science field, this is your case study, okay? This is your case study. This is the typical person. This is what's going on. And so God shows us this case study. Now, let me show you a few things about this. Micah's name literally means who is like God or who is like Jehovah God. All right? So he's got this kind of a God-centric background. Obviously, his mom made sure that he had a name that sounded very religious in nature and that he was close to God. And this is the person, when they say something like, who is like God, he's not asking a question to say, challenge me. What he's saying is who in the world, who in the whole universe is like our God? This is the great God. So it's really more of a declarative statement than it is a question, okay? It's a statement of praise to God, specifically Jehovah God, not just a God. But then did you notice what happened in this story? 1,100 pieces of silver. In that time, it would have been shekels. Let me explain to you what that would have been. If you had 10 shekels, if you got 10 shekels a year, you earned an adequate raise or an adequate wage. In other words, you're kind of like the middle class, all right? You've done fairly well. So this lady and her family has saved up 1,100 of these. This is like 110 years of pretty good, not great, but pretty good wages. So you can understand why she'd be a little bit upset. And this is why she pronounces the curse. And so her curse, and she makes it known to everyone, whoever stole this, the curse from God be upon this person. The son hears this, and he's not a little boy because he has children of his own. Son hears this and realizes, whoa. I've got enough religious stuff in my background that I don't want a curse being on me. So I'm going to come clean. He comes to his mother and says, hey, mom, you know that curse? And yes. And he says, well, I'm the one that stole it. And do you notice what she does? She rewards him. She rewards the brat. She rewards the greedy kid. Because what do we all know? When mom dies, who would get this money? He would. But you know something? He'd had such contempt for his mother that he would sell her out, but then come clean and act like he's the good boy. And the mom had such terrible discipline in the house that she's allowed this brat and greedy kid to grow up. And instead of looking at him and saying, Not that he is a thief, to put a label on him that everything in his life, that he's nothing but a thief, that would be totally unfair. That's not a godly way to handle things. But to look at him and not say, you know, what you did was terrible. We've got to confess this to God. We need to repent. I'm concerned about you. Instead, what does she do? I'm going to take these 200 pieces that I had committed to the Lord, and I'm going to make them as an idol for my son. She rewards his bad behavior. And you notice that right after that is where it says, and Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And then the story continues, and Micah, who has a little bit of religious background, begins to realize, you know something? I don't really need to go to the temple. I don't really need to go somewhere. I'll just set up something here in my home, which was absolutely forbidden by God to do so. You say, well, maybe he was a long ways away. There was tons of places that you could go to worship. But what he did was, is he decided to make his religion very convenient. And he took a lot of the things out of the Jewish culture and a lot of the things out of the laws and tweaked them so that it became very comfortable for himself. And so Micah begins to go down that road. And wouldn't you know it, that fate sometimes sends us people who look very religious but actually aren't in our benefit. Because, see, here was the deal of the day. The Levites were supposed to be taken care of by the people. They got their money. They got the way that they lived through the offerings of the people or the food that they would bring for the sacrifice. All of those things came so that those Levites would have something to live off of, because as a Levite, you were forbidden to own property. So if you had no property, you had no business, okay, and your work was to bring the people's sins before the Lord and to intercede for them, somebody had to take care of you. It lets us know that the temple, the people that were supposed to be going there and worshiping God, had suddenly quit doing so, or were at the very least maybe going but giving absolutely nothing to God. Because here's this Levite, and look at what he's doing. He's looking for a place to stay. And as fate would have it, not as God would have it, the Levite shows up at Micah's home. Who are you? I'm a Levite. And he suddenly realizes, hey, I can manipulate God. I'll put a Levite in charge of me. I will pay for him. Look at what I'm doing, God. Isn't this wonderful? And you know what he's doing? He's just mixing a bunch of religions together and making it up on his own. And he wants this Levite to bless him. And notice what he says at the very end, verse 13. I know the Lord will bless me now because I have a Levite serving as my priest. Now let me ask you this question. None of you in here are Levites. I'm not a Levite. But if you were a Levite, and you showed up at somebody's home and they said, hey, you can live here. I'm going to pay you a middle-class wage. You're really never going to have to work, okay? Because they would tell you, I'm not supposed to do that, okay? And you're going to pay them that amount, and you're going to give them food, and you're going to give them clothes. Let's just say that you're the Levite that's going to receive all of that. Are you going to talk tough to your employer about the way they're living? I doubt it, or else you'll be jobless very soon. And you know, that's what we have a tendency to do. I want to find a place that agrees with me. I want to find a place that'll tell me what I want to hear. I want to find a church. I want to find a pastor that if I say to them or ask them this question, do you feel like that this is wrong? And if they turn to the Bible and say, well, yeah, it does kind of say it here. I don't want that. I want something that'll tell me that what I'm doing is okay. In my lifetime, now maybe I've received the question and I've just forgotten it, but in my lifetime, I've never had anybody come to me directly and say, how can I get as far away from sin as possible? How can I become more holy? Now, some people have asked me questions like, hey, I want to do some better, and I understand that. But the question I normally get is this. Is this wrong? Is it okay? And I'm not saying that those are necessarily bad questions, but what I'm saying is this. We have a tendency to find out how close to the line we can get instead of a tendency to say, how far away can I get? Guess what was happening in that day and time? Well, the scripture tells us, God tells us, there was no king. There was no person really keeping the nation in check. And everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Does that sound fairly familiar? It should. It should. And I will tell you, politics included or politics aside, that's where we are. So, well, how do you know that? How are you really sure? Well, I knew that some people might not take my word for it, so I looked up a Gallup poll that was taken just a few months ago. And it also lists out what these answers were in previous years. Okay? Here was the question that they asked Americans. 1,017 adults nationwide. Okay, so this is just as good as the polling that's going on right now with the whole political race. Thinking for a moment about moral values, how would you rate the overall state of moral values in the country today? As excellent, good, only fair, or poor? In 2002, Americans said 17% of us said that it was good. 2002, 41% of us said only fair. 2002, 40% of us said poor. As it stands today, only 13% say good. 41% says only fair. 44% say poor. Next question. Right now, do you think the state of moral values in the country as a whole is getting better or getting worse? In 2002, 24%, quarter of Americans said it's getting better. In 2008, just a couple of months ago in the month of May, only 11% said it was getting better. As a matter of fact, 81% of Americans say that our moral values are getting worse. And you know, when you think about that, and I know James Carville's statement well, it's the economy, stupid. Okay, yes, that is the way that you do get elected, okay? I would hope as believers that that's not where we always go. I would hope that even as these 81% of Americans that say moral values are declining, that's bigger than the number that says the economy is the number one issue. The problem is this. We think, and we honestly believe this, that if we're okay in our economy, that we'll be okay in moral values and we'll figure it out. And what we don't understand is this. It's linked. I've heard a lot in the last couple of weeks. I wanted to talk about two different things as it relates to the message this morning, and it's things that I feel like that are not the correct way as a Christian and certainly not the correct way as an American to believe. The first one is this, and that is there's a lot of class warfare going on right now, and I mean a lot of it. And there seems to be this, the great thing about what we can do is blame somebody else. And of course, this whole $700 billion rescue, you know, at the first it was a bailout. Now then we changed it to rescue because that sounded better than bailout, right? Okay, you all noticed the change of phrasing there. This $700 billion, everybody's, oh, it was Wall Street, greed on Wall Street, greed on Wall Street. Everybody was fine with Wall Street while they were making money. Nobody said anything then, but all of a sudden it was Wall Street, Wall Street, Wall Street, and I'm sitting there thinking, are we saying that the only greedy people in America are on Wall Street? Because here's what I've found out, and I've known this for years as a pastor because I do a lot of counseling. The wealthy are not the only ones who've cornered the market on being greedy. I've met middle-class people who are as greedy can be. I've met poor people who are as greedy can be. Greed does not check itself at the door when it's knocking and say, oh, this is a poor person. Oh, this is a middle class person. Oh, I'm only welcome at the home of the wealthy. I will honestly tell you this. I've met some great people who are wealthy. I've met some terrible people who are wealthy. I've met some great people who are middle class, and I've met some terrible people who are middle class. I've met some great people who are poor, and I've met some terrible people who are poor. Class has nothing to do with it. But this seems to be the focus. It's not us. It's somebody else. And so I just did a Google search yesterday to say, okay, what are we doing as Americans? Are we greedy? Is it just Wall Street? And you can Google this at home. I think I looked it up underneath, you know, what is the average American debt, I think is what I put in there, like average American debt or something like that. And this is the story that popped up the second or third one down. Okay, this didn't come from anybody's campaign. It's not anybody's push. This was on MSN Money, and it was something that was written 3 years ago. Now listen to what they say in here. This is very interesting. They're talking about the state of the economy. They're talking about how does your debt compare with other people. They've got a little drop-down menu so that you can enter in all these figures and stuff like that. And they're concerned about the economy at this point. Listen to what they say. It says, it's hard not to be worried when confronted with numbers such as these. About 43% of American families spend more than they earn each year. Average households carry some $8,000 in credit card debt. Personal bankruptcies have doubled in the past decade. Now listen to this statement. It's not clear where the debt trend will take the U.S. consumers or the U.S. economy, but it is clear that both are sailing in uncharted waters. I think we know where we're at. We've run aground. And you know, when we look back now, we go, wait a second, we were doing patterns just like what preceded the Great Depression. We were in all of these things. And it's easy to look at Wall Street and say, they're the bad guys. And I want you to know, there are some bad people there. But I don't think we need to think that the middle class is noble, that the poor is noble. Folks, we're all there. Now, let me show you the statistic that really stuck out to me. It says, among the key drivers of debt expansion in recent years, unusually low interest rates, the rising popularity of internet shopping in which credit cards are the currency of choice. Listen to these next two. The hot housing market, which has encouraged buyers to stretch for new homes. The aggressive extension of credit to consumers with weak credit scores. Now, listen to this number. See if it doesn't sound familiar. Americans carry more than $700 billion in revolving debt like bank credit cards and retail cards. Hello? You know something? As those who follow after Christ, we don't need to play the blame game. Okay? Now, we need to identify some issues, but most importantly, and this is where it harkens back to what I talked about last week with Nehemiah, Nehemiah didn't point fingers. Except at himself first. And then he talked about his family had failed. And then he talked about the country. And you know something? A lot of us have really extended ourselves way past what we should. We've been irresponsible. And as someone who follows after Christ, that is not the mark of someone who follows after Christ. I will never forget a year and a half ago when Sherry and I began to look for a home. We wanted something fairly close to downtown. We were looking in Lakewood. I will never forget the banker looking at me and saying to Sherry and I, oh, you've got great credit scores, blah, blah, blah. And the amount that he told us that we could borrow was absolutely obscene. And I laughed at him. Now then, most people know that Sherry and I are givers, but even with that out, even if I kept every single dime, even if the government never got every single dime of mine, I can guarantee you this much. If I would have decided and led my family to follow after that and to say, well, if the bank thinks that we can do this, let's just go do this, I will tell you that you as taxpayers would have been paying to bail out Sherry and me. And when we think about this whole thing with class warfare and all this other stuff, that is not the mark of what Jesus would do. That is not it. That is not where we should go. We should go where Nehemiah went, where Moses went, where Daniel went, where Esther went. That's where we go. We go here. And yes, are we going to be saddled sometimes with other people's stupidity? And then also at some time, people who are deceiving people that are trying to take out loans and tell them, oh yeah, you can pay for it, and they don't understand everything. Yes, sometimes you have to clean up the mess of other people. Yes, sometimes there are greedy people around you that are going to take advantage of you or advantage of someone else, and you're having to pay for it. There is no doubt. You can be the most responsible person on the planet, and you're going to wind up at some point in time having to deal with somebody else. It's difficult. Second thing that I wanted us to talk about this morning, and that is cultural warfare. And to me, that is the one that I've experienced the most, and I'll tell you why. Most of you know that I was born in Springfield, Missouri, so in that southwestern part of Missouri, but then from the age of 8 on, I lived in Arkansas. And I will tell you that the cultural difference between urban America and rural America is very different. It doesn't make one superior over the other. But I will tell you in my experience, because I've been in those farming communities and I've pastored there and I've loved those people and I've also railed those people when they've chosen incorrectly or when they have certain prejudices. But I will tell you, when I've been in Cleveland, I've seen a lot of racial discrimination. And so this whole notion that, oh, it's down in the South. Yeah, it's in the South. It's up here too. I've seen it. I've heard it. I've read it in print. And I will tell you, the whole cultural warfare bothers me because it's divisive. It's if to say, if I move to the city and I have this wonderful exchange of ideas, that I'm above that person out in rural America that just wouldn't quite understand. But for the same person that lives out in rural America that just says, oh, you've sold out, I don't know what you're all about, you're weird, and that's just as wrong. So I don't want you to think, oh, he's just talking down city. No, because I can give you a few phone numbers of some country folk that you'll love their accent, number one. Number two is they'll say, we liked him, but boy, I'm going to tell you, that boy stepped on our feet a couple times. Because my calling is to speak the truth in love. And they know that I love them. But they know that I will tell them, this is not responsible, this is not good, this is the way Christ would have us live. And now that I've been around the city, I can tell you that there's some irresponsibility there. There's some this attitude of, you know, well, they just wouldn't understand. I will never forget when Sherry went with me to the first Christmas in southwest Missouri, to Springfield, Missouri, just outside of there at a little town called Republic. And that's where all of my relatives gather, and they will this Christmas as well. And I will never forget the look on Sherry's face as one of my cousins entered the room, uncle, my brother, and her eyes, I could tell, were a little bit like, really? These people do exist. It was like the camouflage convention of the United States of America had come to Republic, and all of them were of my family. And my cousin Aaron comes in and talks about when he went turkey hunting the other day. And my brother talks about his bass boat. By the way, my brother was a professional bass fisherman for several years. I know the culture extremely well. My Uncle Bob, that were on there at his farm with the cows, and all of a sudden, my little bitty nephew Jake comes running in. And he had seen the cows outside. And cows, cows, cows. He loves cows. Why does he love cows? Because he has cows of his own, even as a 3, 4, 5-year-old. And there was my cousin Tricia with her husband Danny, and that's their little boy Jake. And he comes walking in, and he's got his camouflage on, and he says, you know, to Sherry, how do you do? You know, Sherry, what is this man? Her eyes were this big. And I leaned over to her. I said, you've never seen anything like this before. And she goes, huh? And what she found out, they're some of the most loving, kind, genuine people. But she was enamored by their conversation because it was conversations about cows and how much heads of cattle that they had and what you could get for a head of cattle. And it's not the way it used to be. And she's just going, I didn't even know the way that it was. I was just, is that where we get hamburger from? You know, I'm kidding. She didn't say that. I'm just teasing. She didn't say she knew that. But I'm going to tell you, it was just kind of like this, wow. It's like, yeah, this is who they are. It's who they are. What she found out was, wow, and they really love you, man. And they really love me. And you know, if it's the one thing that I can kind of help people with the city is you haven't arrived. And neither have they. Because I'm going to tell you something. If you were to go out to a farm town today and you were to tell that farmer, and if you could just envision yourself out by the barbed wire fence and the cows are out in the pasture and the pond's over there and the wind's blowing a little bit and it's a fall time of the year and he's got his leather jacket on and it's old and worn through and he's got tired old eyes. And you looked at him and you told him all the things you've learned in the city and all the ideas that have been exchanged and just how much you've grown and everything else. And in this current day and climate, and you rattled on about all those other things and all the ideas exchanged, he would be really, really quiet because that's usually the way that they are. And then he would look at you and he would ask you this question. Which exchange of idea got us that $700 billion problem? While sometimes they may appear a little bit backwards, there's a little bit of wisdom. And it's something we can all learn from. And my defense this morning is not of the country person, because as I told you before, you can call one of them right now and they'll go, woo, sometimes he'd get on us a little. But we needed it. And my concern as we head into this political thing, man, it is just about as divisive as can be. As much as there's a call for unity, I'm like, I've lived in both places. Some of you have never lived there. I'm not saying you have to. I'm just telling you, from both urban to rural, there's just this huge rift. And there's just this huge, you know, you just need to arrive. Well, you just are dumb. That is not the mark of a Christ follower. It's just not the mark. It's not who we need to be. What I would say to you is this. There's a couple of things as believers we need to be. Number one is we need to be responsible, okay? I know some of you are still in school, you know, and just out of school, so you're paying off school debt. That's not the type of debt that's bad, okay? That's an investment. There's a big difference. But, man, we just stretch ourselves way too far. We've really created a lot of this problem, okay? We just tune up credit like nobody's business. Pay down your credit cards. Get them down. You're going to kill the next generation. You're going to saddle them with so much debt, and you think, oh, it's somebody else. No, it's us. It's us. And I can't say that Sherry and I have always made the right decisions, but I will tell you this. We've never carried, and hopefully we'll never have to, unless an emergency happens, there's no way around it, we've never carried a credit card balance over. But man, I leverage them for all the frequent flyer miles that I can get, okay? They don't like me, okay, because we don't pay them anything. Now, I understand sometimes you're in tough situations. That's not what I'm talking about. But I'm talking about, did you really need the big screen TV? Did you really need the newer car? Did you really need the nicest of the nice? We as Christians, as Christ followers, need to be responsible. The second thing we need to be is unifiers. We don't need to look down on anybody because of where they came from or what their belief system is. It's not right. That's not godly. That's arrogant. That's pride. And the third thing that I would tell you is this. We need to be courageous. And I will tell you the one moral value that I believe is lost in America is the word courage. And you're going to say, no, we've got all these fighting men and women. No, that's not what I'm talking about. That's not what I'm talking about. We're well equipped militarily. We've got courageous people out there. That's not people I'm referring to. What I'm referring to is this. And if you caught some of the debates going on with the $700 billion package and how we needed to do this, I have no idea whether we did or didn't. I'm just kind of like, whatever, this is beyond me. I think most people were there. Most financial analysts will tell you they're not even sure that this will work. They have no clue. No one can definitively come out and say this will absolutely work. So it's a little bit nerve-wracking to vote for that. I understand that. But do you know how many of our congressional leaders were told by their leaders, hey, we know you're in the middle of a re-election. You don't have to vote on this. What? What kind of courage is that? It's not courage. That's cowardice. What I will say to you is this. What if we would have told all of those people in advance that voted for this thing? Yes or no, didn't matter, okay? 15% of you in this room, this is to our Congress, 15% of you in this room will die as a result of this, or one of your children will. 21% of you will lose everything, all your houses, all your lands, all your money, all your retirement, and you will die in rags. Now, if we were to tell them that, how many do you think would have actually gone out there to vote? And I'm not trying to be judgmental. I'm just saying that I think we all know. So people would be hiding saying, oh, well, you know. And what I will tell you is this. The numbers and statistics that I gave you were the results of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence. We've lost the moral value of courage. Because in Scripture it says, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And where are we? Don't tell me what to think. Don't tell me what to believe. What I do is what I do. I don't doubt that what you do is what you do. But if you look through history, and this has nothing to do with a political statement, it is reality. If you want to know the decline of nations, and it's all of them. So look in your history books, and those of you who are history buffs, you know this. Here's the decline. The temple or the faith center goes. The second thing that goes is the family. And the third thing that goes is the state. And we all know it. And in this story, what did we see? The faith, the temple, people were leaving it. Second thing that went was the family structure, blessing and condoning things that were terrible and rewarding those bad behaviors. And the third thing that went was the state. It's throughout every society that's ever been known. Just go back and look in your history books. Now, where do you think we are? Well, 82% of Americans say that we're in a huge moral decline. That's not just Christians. It's Americans. They didn't say, hey, you know, let's just poll the Christians, see what they think. They usually kind of have a gloomy, doomy outlook. Now, I will say this to you. I'm not ready to give up. And I don't think you should be either. As bad as it sometimes can get, here's what I know. We're one good decision away from following after God. All of us personally and as a nation. We're one good decision away. And you're maybe thinking, which political candidate is he talking about? I'm not talking about a political candidate at this point. What I'm talking about is our hearts. To be courageous to say, it's the right thing to do no matter what it costs me. It's the right thing to do. We need to be the right people no matter what it costs. And so what I will tell you is this, and most of you thought, I thought this was about politics. It is. We need to encourage those people who are those types of leaders to do the right thing no matter what it costs, because it's really not about the economy, stupid. Because when that moral decay hits, God's not going to bless. You know what the false assumption of Micah was? Hey, I've got a priest now that's telling me what I'm doing is good. It's great. It's wonderful. God didn't bless. He removed his hand. It's a tough time. It's not an easy topic. I like to talk about positive things, but I will say this to you. I still believe that God can radically shape this country, even if just a few call on him. Because in the Bible, it never took a mass of people. It took just a few. Think about it. The first disciples were a result of them going out and sharing the good news. It was just a few. It wasn't a mass of people. We're the result of their faithfulness and other people sharing that story down through centuries. I want everyone just to bow their head and close their eyes. And I don't really care this morning if you're Republican, Democrat, or independent. There's all three in this room, whether you realize it or not. I know it to be true because I've talked to a lot of you. And I want you to know that regardless of what happens with electing a president, the bigger issue is, what are we going to do with God? Are we going to let God be God, or are we just going to do what's right in our own eyes? Proverbs says there's a way that seems right to a man, but it leads in death, and it ends in death. And when we look around, and I think all of us in this room know, things are a little bit different. People are a little bit different than those original founding fathers. Not that they were perfect, not that what they said was gospel, but boy, that word courage is so true. And they all knew by signing it that it possibly meant their death. So God, we come before you now. We're a nation, for the most part, that believes in the individual so much that the individual trumps you. And Father, while you've created us to be incredibly creative, to be incredibly intuitive, to be incredibly gifted, and to go out and make life better, not just for us, but for others, we've warped that and we've twisted it. And really what we listen to a lot of times with political candidates is what are you going to give me? What are you going to do for me? And very few times have we wondered, I wonder how this will bring us back to God. I wonder how this will affect children and grandchildren. I wonder what the moral decay is going to continue to be, because there is no legislation that can affect the heart. And so, God, we just come humbly before you from every political party to independent to those who are just tired of all of it. And we humbly seek you as God, and we say, Lord, forgive us where we've been irresponsible. Forgive us where we have cost ourselves and our witness, and we haven't been able to give to the things that you want us to give to and be a part of the things you want us to be a part of, because we've just been selfish. And so, Father, I just ask you to right now on my behalf, Lord, you know of my sin. You know of the things that I do incorrectly. Father, may I never lose the courage to do what's right, even if it costs me everything. And Father, may we as Gateway Church never forsake that principle, and that we would fail to be courageous, not to be ugly to people or demeaning or arrogant, but that we would be humble in our approach, and that we would seek to try to make change, because you've asked us to be transforming agents, to be your ambassadors in our society. And so, God, we just give you these next few moments just to do a work on our heart, because past all the politics, one of these days we're going to give an account to you. An account for what we said, account for what we did. And Father, I pray that our values will mirror your values, and that we will fall in love with you deeper every day, even if nobody around us comes with us. I just pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.